Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the Trump administration's environmental impact 6 months in, and a tiny desert concert featuring intergalactic neo-soul band Hyperbella. But first, as you may have heard on Morning Edition today, NPR and Marist are out with new poll numbers which suggest that over three-quarters of Americans view democracy as under threat. While Democrats and Republicans differ sharply on the nature of that threat, there seems to be broad agreement that resistance of some kind is an urgent matter. But how best to resist? In recent weeks, we've seen hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets, from the so-called Tesla takedown protests to the standoffs with ICE in Los Angeles and other cities, to the wave of No Kings protests. Many of these events were peaceful, featuring lots of music and dancing. But some turned violent, highlighting an unmistakable cultural undercurrent of outrage and anger. Conversations about the virtues of joy and anger feel urgent in activist communities. And so for today's Culture Cap, we have invited two people who have thought deeply about both approaches. Marisa Mata-Avalos is an artist and community organizer here in Phoenix. She recently organized a pride party with the tagline, "Joy is the protest." Marisa, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And joining us live from Tucson is Haz, a curator, facilitator, and multimedia artist, and the creator of The Anger Project. Haz, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you both for being here. Marisa, let me start with you. Very simple question. How was that party?
It was so fun. We had a mix of very close friends show up, family members, and also just random strangers that saw it on the internet. So it was really cool to have new people in my front yard and in my house.
Oh, it was at your house?
Yeah.
Okay, very generous of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell me what this joy looked like at the party. How did that manifest itself?
We had an open mic segment, and people offered up poetry. Some people brought their instruments and played music about love and about queer experience. We had a lot of rainbow decorations, a lot of people smiling, embracing each other, and laughing. My dogs were there. There's a lot of joy from seeing the dogs.
Dogs are definitely keystones for joy, I find. Haz, can I ask you, how much has Pride been a context for the anger work and workshops that you've been doing recently?
Well, I think that I'm not really sure, actually. I guess I've never thought about it in that way.
Okay.
In terms of Pride. I do want to say that I think that the event that with the Joy event sounds phenomenal. I think mm-hmm. Joy is really important, especially in this time when, you know, so many terrible things are happening. But in terms of anger, one of the reasons that I think it's so important to talk about anger and engage with anger in ways that are boundaried and also community oriented, I think it's because it's difficult to feel pride if you're dealing with a lot of suppressed emotions. And I think that anger is a very taboo emotion. I think it's often racialized and classed and gendered. And I think it's so often used as a way to suppress and silence the truth. And so my desire to talk about and work with and engage with anger is really rooted in a desire to get to all of the emotions that are kind of suppressed within places that are stuck. Right? Because there isn't always an ability to talk about and express our emotions in a way where we're validated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me ask you, Haz, if you could introduce us a little bit to what the Anger Project is. How do you work with folks on kind of connecting with these emotions that many are encouraged to keep suppressed?
Sure. Well, there are many different components of the Anger Project. One of the biggest components is workshops. So there are workshops that are facilitated where we talk about and engage with anger, and we go through different kinds of embodiment activities to help us work with our anger. In the workshops, we might scream, we might dance, we might sing. Sometimes we paint, write, play. Sometimes we smash things. A lot of it centers around sharing stories as well. So there are always opportunities for usually at least one time and sometimes even two times during a session where we go around in a circle and everyone has an opportunity to share their own experiences. And again, you know, it's really important to have boundaries in these spaces. So the way that it's facilitated hopefully will create as safe a space as possible. I don't think there are ever any safe spaces, but the objective is really to allow everyone space and time to be able to speak about their experiences in a way that feels good, which can even be opting out. Part of this process is about paying attention to how you're feeling inside and learning how to listen to the emotions that are happening within your body. So you might come into to this space and decide that you don't really want to share. And I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something I really hear in your reply there is this idea that it's not as much about encouraging people to be angry as much as it is about letting them be angry if that's what they need to be. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah. And talking about that and expressing it in a way where you're not doing harm. You're not harming anybody in the space. Mm-hmm. You're not harming yourself, but you're able to work through it. I think one of the things that has always, I think just confused me about the spiritual movement. And I know that I'm talking about this as a monolithic whole, which I know isn't accurate, right? That's not realistic. But in a lot of those spaces, I've heard people say things like, you know, don't be angry. You shouldn't be angry, which is not realistic. You know, if you're human, you're going to feel all of the emotions, right? They're just there to tell us what we need to do in our lives, right?
Right.
But sometimes I'll hear people say, oh, just, you know, go meditate. And I'm like, wow, you know, if you're really angry, meditating is probably the last step you want to do. Like really your nervous system is just vibrating. You need to be able to get it out. So go for a walk, you know, punch at the air, dance in your house, do something so that you can actually move the physical energy through your body in a way that doesn't hurt you, doesn't hurt anybody else. And then when your body is finally relaxed, your nervous system is actually regulated, then meditate, right? So I think it's really about the way we talk about anger. I think there's just the way we talk about anger and the way that we engage with it can often be harmful because of this cultural, this kind of overarching cultural, which I really think is part of, you know, systemic oppression.
Sure, sure. Marisa, let me ask you, joy strikes me as something, particularly in difficult times for a given community, as an emotion that can also be somewhat shamed, somewhat stigmatized. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people can feel like it's irresponsible to feel joy when there is so much suffering. How much does that come up in your work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking when Haz was speaking about the people's spiritual practice, and that I have heard that also in spiritual spaces that anger is like a lower emotion. Mm. A lot of like guru people are like right. Raise your vibration, good vibes only. So I definitely want to echo what Haz is saying that meditation can take on different forms, and running could be a meditation. And creating art is half destroying, right? So like smashing things, I think can also be meditative.
Uh-huh.
And to your other question about joy, I think in the spaces where I am, people understand that it's hard to find that in them, like the joy, because there's so much wrong with the world. So I think people appreciate the space to be happy and to be okay in community. There is like a boundary And I think the word self-care comes up when I'm thinking about this. It's like the balance between taking care of yourself and making sure that your soul and your being is joyful, but also balancing that with not completely detaching from what's going on. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, but we gotta stay human.
Yes. Marisa, I wanted to pick up on something you were saying just a moment ago. You mentioned community. Mm-hmm. And something that I left out when I was introducing you and talking about this event that you recently threw, where one of the taglines was, joy is the protest. The second part of that was, community is the shield, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you mean by that.
So I do a lot of volunteering with different organizations, and recently I was in a neighborhood that had a lot of political flags. I'm not sure if I can say which ones, but I was feeling very unsafe in this neighborhood, and it just kind of got me a little angry, also a little territorial. In the area where I live, there's been a lot of gentrification, a lot of the community building that we've been working on for the past 10, 11 years. A couple years ago, we started to see people slip out, people get pushed out, and new people come in, which, of course, like, we welcome the foreigner, but also, like, we don't want our friends to get kicked out, you know? So just thinking about the shifting in my neighborhood and what my home looks like to passerbyers, I thought about getting a pride flag, or my family is of Mexican descent, so getting like a Mexican flag. There's also been pushback on protesters carrying the Mexican flag, right?
Right, yes.
So thinking about that and feeling resentful that I have to feel that like hesitation in my own neighborhood about doing that.
Right.
Especially since, you know, there's like Supreme Court justices who have no qualm putting up their political flags.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, just a little bit of anger, a little bit of like wanting to stand my ground and say like, this is my neighborhood and this is our culture here in my neighborhood. And we are welcoming people. We are happy, joyful people. We are loving people.
Right.
And so that's part of the reason why we wanted to have the event be partially in the front yard.
Okay.
And we put up a bunch of like rainbow balloons and all of that stuff. And
right.
Yeah, I guess just wanting to make sure that we are visible,
mm-hmm.
and that we are seen in numbers,
mm-hmm.
and that we internalize that we are not alone.
But critically, it seems like what you're saying is not just visible, but visibly joyful, visibly
yes.
Not mourning or bemoaning necessarily, although obviously those mm-hmm. are emotions that I'm sure are present too.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm hearing you right, there is a power in a mass of people demonstrating a certain relationship to other pressures in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Haas, I want to ask you, you know, you were speaking a moment ago about the importance on an individual basis for people in discovering a connection with anger, if that's what they feel they need to express. But what do you think is the importance of showing anger? I know part of what you do is put together these showings of the work that comes out of your workshops. Why is it good for people to see the anger of others?
Well, I think it's helpful for people to see their anger so that it doesn't continue to be this taboo way of expressing what's within ourselves. Because when we're not allowed, like when it's pushed down and when we're suppressing it, I think it can come into our lives in ways that are really harmful. And I think that having the ability to express how we're feeling and our emotions, I think it's very important. I also want to speak a little bit to what Marisa just said. And one, I think that what you're doing sounds so amazing, because I think that finding pleasure and joy in a world that profits from our brokenness and dysfunction is a radical act in itself, right? I think that's also very important. So I don't see these two ideas in opposition to each other at all. I see them as ways of working with emotion. Mm-hmm. And I also think that the Anger Project isn't about isolation. I think maybe I've talked about it in that way a little bit, but I don't mean it in that way. It's definitely a community-oriented project, mm-hmm. Specifically because I've been dealing with my anger and isolating myself, and it's not helpful. You know, at a certain place in my life, I was wondering like why I felt so stuck. And I think because I was so afraid to say how I felt, I was so afraid to express my feelings around anger. Mm-hmm. And so it's felt very important to make this a community-oriented project as well.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you both. I mean, I hear in the way that you're talking about this a real fluency with the broader cultural context in which your work is taking place. You've both been doing this work for some time. Marisa, let me start with you. How would you characterize this particular moment of community organizing, putting on events like the Pride Party you were just describing, as compared to previous administrations, previous cultural pressures that you have felt a need to engage with through protest of some kind?
I think I'm most closely connected to the Hispanic Latino community here in Arizona. I think people are quicker to get it. Like,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Sharing like, hey, like I'm doing this event. It's important for us to be together in solidarity. Let me know if there's anything you need and please come through. I think people are like, they get it. Like they're like, yeah.
A bit of a shorthand.
That makes sense.
It sounds like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Haas, what about you? How do you feel that people are quicker to get on board with the mission of anger than they have been previously? Or has it shifted?
Well, I think it might be similar to what Marisa was just talking about. I think that as a person who's genderqueer and who's moved in some more marginal spaces, I think the people who are generally attracted to this work are people who have some level, if not multiple levels, of marginalization on their bodies, being put on their bodies. So I think the people who are attracted to this work are people who want to have safe spaces to speak about and explore and engage with anger.
Well, I have been speaking with Marisa Mata-Avalos and Haas, both artists and educators working in a variety of emotional tones on resistance of various kinds. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good morning, it's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what happens when a musical theater kid and a classically trained pianist make music together? The answer, intergalactic neo-soul. We'll hear from the local band Hyperbella in our latest Tiny Desert concert. But first, a new survey measuring how much control parents have over their children's education finds Arizona near the top nationwide. The Parent Power Index from the Center for Education Reform looks at criteria including school choice, innovation, and charter schools in a given state. Arizona ranked second in the country, including high scores for charter schools and choice programs, including vouchers and tax credits. Dr. Katie Nelligan is a former teacher and a research fellow at the Center for Education Reform. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about this, and they started with what stands out about Arizona in this report.
So Arizona earned second place, 92% in a grade of A on the 2025 Parent Power Index, ranking second nationally. Its bold policies, groundbreaking innovations, and unwavering commitment to educational freedom that empowers parents with maximum control is really what drives it to the top. So you see multiple tax credit scholarships in Arizona available for families. You also have a universal education savings account. which over 86,000 students currently participate in. And it really allows families to access a learning environment that fits them best with no barriers, no limits. And then that contributing score also is Arizona's charter sector. It's one of the strongest in the nations. You see a multitude of different schools specializing anywhere from children with autism all the way to hybrid models that allow parents, again, to access educational models that might not be present in the traditional system.
Are you finding that the laws on the books are also sort of being implemented on the ground the way that you would want?
We see that Arizona has always been a pioneer in education reform for decades. You have some of the earliest charter school legislation happening in 1994. You have pioneering tax credit scholarships that happened in the late 90s. You had the first ESA program launched in 2011. And then recently in 2022, you had universal, meaning that all families in the state could apply for a scholarship. And the way that that has impacted implementation is transformational because you see these new school models that are starting to emerge. You see micro schools, you see really dynamic charter schools that are opening up because this policy is allowing the educators and it's allowing parents to really drive a system of change.
One of the criticisms about the universal ESA program in Arizona is that a not insignificant number of families that are taking advantage of it are those that have never been in public schools, that have always paid to send their students to private schools, and are now just having the state pick up some of the tab for that. I guess I'm curious, like, what you make of that argument.
Yeah, I think, it's still, again, in its early phases. Education savings accounts is a relatively new choice movement, but I really believe that a robust choice environment is a rising tide that lifts all boats. It does so by driving innovation, expanding opportunity, pushing every part of the education system to do better. And it might be the fact that those families that are already in the private school are just more aware of the resources available to them. But you have families that are starting to engage in this now, and it's really expanding what's possible for students. It's expanding what's possible for educators, and it's expanding what's possible for families to really drive an education that best fits the needs of their child.
Is it possible, do you think, to have a robust school choice system in a given state, not specifically necessarily in Arizona, but just in general, while also having a robust, well-funded public district school education system? And I ask because one of the other big criticisms of universal ESAs in Arizona is that lawmakers have underestimated the cost of the program. It's costing a lot more than folks thought, which is in turn taking money away from public education.
Yeah, and I think that's often a misconception that a lot of folks, when they learn the information, they really understand that these education savings accounts are funded on the state's per pupil dollar, so no local property tax. So when a student opts into an ESA, their school district is keeping all of the local and federal funding, while the smaller state amount is typically around $700 or $7,500. Is provided to the student's ESA. And I know that there were lots of concerns around that, around, are these programs fiscally irresponsible? But in fiscal year 2024, Arizona's Department of Education actually reported a $4.3 million surplus, which contradicts the claims that, education savings accounts were draining the budget.
How do you find the distribution geographically of choice? I mean, obviously, for example, in Arizona, a lot of schools that students and families can choose from in the Phoenix area, in the Tucson area, in the more metro areas. I'm wondering about more rural, rural out-of-town communities.
Right. And that's kind of the beauty of these choice programs is that when these programs are made universal, students across the state, regardless of geography, can access these programs. And when the program is implemented with fidelity and excitement, you see educators that are now popping up starting to want to make their own school or creating new opportunities in rural areas that might not exist outside of the traditional public school.
Are you seeing around the country, if not specifically in Arizona, that there are private schools opening in more rural communities?
Yes, definitely. You see it in West Virginia, you see it in Florida. You have a lot of schools that are popping up, and they don't look like a traditional private school that you would think of that's, been well established. I talk a lot about micro schools, which is a really engaging way that families feel supported and are excited about smaller classroom size. They're excited about really dynamic education models or curriculum that's being provided at these smaller private schools.
Is this the kind of thing, do you think, that it's going to take some time to really understand the full impact of, having students able to go to any number of schools and using any number of different types of curricula, different types of models, that kind of thing? Like, is this the kind of situation where we're not going to know for a number of years, maybe until these students are out of high school, maybe even out of college, like what the real implications are of all this?
Yeah, it's going to take some time, but I think we're already starting to see some of the impacts, especially around those kind of hard to measure quantitative descriptors that you often see in the news, right? Test scores, you see all of those graduation rates. And I think a lot of these new school models now, you see different types of results. And it was a product of COVID where parents saw what was happening and they wanted something different. And so it's definitely going to take a little bit to be able to measure this really well and to measure it qualitatively and both quantitatively, but we're already starting to see some of the qualitative impacts in the system and families that are so excited about these new school models and are excited about the innovation that's happening. And it's totally changing the education sector for the better.
All right. That is Katie Nelligan, a research fellow at the Center for Education Reform. Katie, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
For more than 15 years, American environmental policy has been guided largely by a pivotal declaration by the EPA. In 2009, the agency announced the so-called endangerment finding, which stated that the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere endangers public health and welfare. Among other things, this finding mandated the EPA to take action under the Clean Air Act to curb emissions and take a variety of other actions in an attempt to prevent the long-term dangers of climate change. But earlier this year, President Trump's new EPA administrator, Lee Zeldin, said this.
I've been told the endangerment finding is considered the holy grail of the climate change religion. For me, the U.S. Constitution and the laws of this nation will be strictly interpreted and followed. No exceptions. Today, the Green New Scam ends.
Obviously, there's a lot to unpack there, but equating the endangerment finding with religion is, needless to say, quite a shift. And Zeldin's statement was followed by a raft of policy rollbacks that threaten decades of climate-related work. But this is also not the first time that a Republican administration or a Democratic administration have targeted environmental policies. So how does this moment compare to the efforts of previous presidents? Joining us now to discuss is Sandy Barr, director of the Sierra Club's Arizona chapter, which is technically called the Grand Canyon chapter. Sandy, good morning.
Good morning.
Sandy, you have been doing this work for decades, right?
Correct, yes.
So how would you characterize this moment in terms of the threat to climate change related initiatives?
This administration is truly the biggest threat we have seen to progress on addressing climate change. We've seen some hits before, but this is an all-out assault on provisions that have been in place for a while that help us to reduce emissions and address the climate crisis. And they're hitting it at every level.
So one thing I sort of alluded to there in the intro is the executive orders that were announced in conjunction with Administrator Zeldin's statement. I believe there were, what was it, 31 executive orders and other changes that day?
Yes. Administrator Zeldin announced that there were 31 rollbacks that they were going to address, including the endangerment finding. And the thing about the endangerment finding, well, first of all, it is based on science, and there was a lot that went into it before it was established. It was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it from it, all of the authority that EPA has to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, carbon, methane, that all comes from that endangerment finding per the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act is still the law of the land as far as our air quality. So the fact that they're saying they want to reverse it, that's huge and we think inconsistent with the law.
Okay. Well, so let's talk about this variety of rollbacks that were announced and in some cases implemented back in January. What are the ones that have taken effect so far that for you are the most significant?
Yeah, it's hard to pick, but right now they are in the middle of repealing the carbon rule to limit carbon emissions from power plants. That's something that will affect us here directly in Arizona. There's a public comment session next week, but that's moving forward very quickly. The executive orders reversing any kind of focus on environmental justice or climate justice, eliminating programs that benefit a variety of people with low incomes and on tribal nations, and really overall just taking a sledgehammer to our protections and to our climate policies.
You mentioned, obviously, the impacts here in Arizona of things like the changes to plant regulations. How much leeway, theoretically speaking, would Governor Hobbs and the state legislature have to intervene if there were ways in which they wanted to counteract changes that are being made at the federal level?
Well, very little when it comes to the emissions part of it, because the legislature, a previous legislature, passed and then Governor Brewer at the time signed a bill that says that the Department of Environmental Quality can't do anything to measure or reduce greenhouse gas emissions unless the legislature specifically tells it it can. So they really can't do anything specifically on the emissions end. They can continue with implementing some of the clean energy programs that are in place through the Office of Resiliency, but that's only as long as they have any funding to do so.
How much were environmental concerns part of the recent legislative session?
Well, there were a lot of bad environmental bills, so it was a big part of it as far as there were a lot of bills to try and advantage gas and coal to the detriment of solar and wind and clean energy overall. Most of those did die because the governor vetoed them, or some of them died in the legislature. But one bill the governor signed, and that will result in a coal plant staying open longer. So we're very disappointed in that part. So it was a real loss this session as far as climate and clean energy.
Just about 30 seconds left here, Sandy. Looking ahead, how optimistic are you that a future administration would be able to make up for the loss of progress on environmental issues?
Well, I always remain optimistic about people coming through and recognizing the harm. The big problem is it takes a lot longer to build than to destroy, and they're destroying a lot of policies right now. So I'm concerned about the timeline because we need to be acting now on climate, reducing those emissions, implementing these policies, and we're going backwards.
All right. Well, that is Sandy Barr, the director of the Sierra Club's Arizona chapter, the Grand Canyon chapter. Sandy, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman, and now it is time for another Tiny Desert concert. Self-described intergalactic neo-soul band Hyperbella is known for their energetic performances and songs you can't help but bop your head to. At the beginning of this year, Hyperbella embarked on their rebirth tour, officially marking the band's return from a four-year hiatus. In this second iteration of Hyperbella, instead of being a four-piece band, Cassidy Hilgers and Carly Bates were at the helm together, playing as a duo or hiring other musicians to create a full band sound. Hilgers sings and plays bass and guitar. Bates sings and plays keyboard. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with both of them recently, and he started by asking Hilgers what it was like to write songs with one other person rather than three.
That was a really different way of writing for us. Like, we had to engineer the whole demos. We basically wrote every part, and then we would hire musicians to play the songs on the recording. And now we're doing that by hiring these baddies, Jake Silverman, Connor Sample, and Benjamin Cortez. And we've just fallen in love, man. There's a lot of love.
What is your process like? Because you obviously are playing different instruments, but you also sing together. You both have fairly extensive musical backgrounds. What is your process together? How does that work?
For most of the songs, we would just kind of get together and see what, you know, was present in our creative, present in our
juice.
Bodies, our juice. We would kind of direct each other in terms of, we've got this groove going. Cass would ask me to like lay some chords down and we'd workshop that together. And then we'd like switch roles and Cass would find another part that layered really nicely on top of it. We basically created the whole track before we'd write lyrics, which we also did together, kind of exploring, you know, what are some of the things that we each want to talk about and how do we communicate that with metaphor and rhymes and all the things. It was really collaborative at every step of the way.
Yeah, it sounds like you really did almost everything together.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
All right, can you guys play a song for us?
Yeah, this one is called Say Something.
Oh,
So each of you had some jazz background growing up. I mean, Carly, you said you started with classical, but then moved to jazz. And Cassidy, you started a little bit, it sounds like, with jazz.
Yeah.
Is that something you're thinking about as you're creating these songs?
I think that the thing that jazz or a jazz education is or has like really helped us with in Hyperbella is our understanding of harmony and ensemble playing and... meter, we play around with a lot of mixed meter writing. So yeah, I think a lot of our influences are also influenced by jazz, but not necessarily like in the box jazz artists themselves. So yeah, there's kind of a gray area, I would say.
Do you find that musical theater is like showing itself in your work now?
I'd say like performing on stage for sure. The way I relate to lyrics and the way my body moves.
You definitely had a lot of movement while you were playing.
Yes, we like to move.
Yeah, fun. Yeah.
Yeah, so blessings to musical theater. Yes.
Well, it's interesting because I have to say, just as an outside observer watching you perform, yes, you're definitely playing the music, but it really looks like you are almost more feeling the music than just playing it or performing it. Like, is that something that you are aware of when you're doing it?
Yeah, I'd say these songs specifically, when we wrote them, it was during COVID, actually, and it was all the deep stuff we've been wanting to say and talk about, and Carly and I had the space and time to do that together during lockdown. So I think these songs hit differently when we perform them now, and we can really just immerse ourselves and be in that moment that we wrote the song about.
A lot of the stuff you're writing about are very personal type things that have happened to you or things that are personal. Like, is there a line that you are, like, I guess, how do you decide what you're willing to let the world see or know about you or about hurt that you've had or experiences that you've had, and what maybe do you not want to put into a song?
Maybe it depends on each song. Like, say something, I probably wouldn't tell you exactly what it means. But so the audience can kind of interpret what that means for them. But other songs, like we wrote a song about my cat named Machka who died, and she lived to be 21. So that's like explicitly about a cat, and you can kind of hear the lyrics and how that would be, oh, that's a cat. But I feel like we kind of hide the true meaning a little bit, and I don't know why, but we do that.
Yeah, I think that's the cool thing about songwriting is like you can be really, really vulnerable, but not necessarily explicit with what it is that you're, yeah, what the topic is or what the details are. And I think an audience, or our intention is that our audience can connect with that in whatever way, project their own meaning onto these songs.
When you know what the song is about and it's about something particularly personal, does that affect how you perform it, Cassidy?
Definitely.
How so?
I feel like, well, every time I sing Say Something in the end, it is like, so when I recorded that in the studio, I think we did maybe like 3 takes, and I never wrote a part for that ending. It was just like, we'll see what happens in the studio. And that was probably like the best moment musically for me, like just emotion wise, not like singing wise, but yeah, that was pretty good too. Anyway, but emotionally, because I like was literally sobbing by the time I got done with that. And like, I try to go there every time I perform it live and just like really immerse myself into that moment and the meaning. Yeah.
That sounds like it would be emotionally exhausting to try to get yourself to a point of like breaking down in tears every time you sing a song, or, you know, go to a particular place every time you perform a song. It sounds like it would be a lot for you.
It does, but it's like you feel the most alive, like when I'm on stage, and especially with this band, it's like very safe. And yeah, it's like the best feeling in the world, actually. Yeah.
All right. Can you guys play something on the way out for us?
Yeah, we're going to play Weighted Miles. This song is a dedication to your worst ex that you've ever had.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.